this week's parsha of Parshat Tzav, it's the second parsha within Sefer Vayikra, within the book of Vayikra, and really continues with the theme which began last week in Parshat Vayikra, laws pertaining to, concerning the korbanos, the various sacrifices that were offered in the temple. And Parshat Tzav in particular deals with the miluim, deals with the whole service, the seven-day preparation service, of making sure the kohanim, the priests, and all the vessels were purified in order to do the service demanded of them and of it in the service of God in the tabernacle. I'd like to focus today on the beginning of the parsha, which is a very fascinating selection on a number of levels, and I'd like to really focus in on one particular, raise a number of questions, and then begin our study, which I think, even though it seems so obscure, has tremendous relevant and practical implications for our lives. Let's take a look at the source in its entirety, the beginning of Parashat Tzav. Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, "Command Aaron and his son, saying, this is the law of the elevation offering, the law of the Ola, where the law, the Korban Ola, was, as we know, burned completely, was lifted completely and burned on the altar. And we know the different sacrifices, like a chatat, a sin offering. So part of it was burned and part of it the priest ate. And shlamim, from the word shalom, peace, part of it was burned, part of it the priest ate, and part of it the individual bringing the sacrifice would eat. So different sacrifices had different laws concerning it, but the ola was burned completely to God. Continuing in the Chumash, it is the elevation offering that stays on the flame on the altar all night until the morning. So it was burned completely over a course of time, and the fire of the altar should be kept aflame on it. The Kohen shall don his fitted linen tunic, he shall don linen breeches on his flesh, he shall separate the ash of what the fire consumed in the elevation offering on the altar and place it next to the altar. He shall remove his garment and don other garments, and he shall move the ash to the outside of the camp to a pure place." And that's a fascinating law, which we're not going to deal with today, the removal of the ashes, which necessitated a change of clothing, which is clearly a Musar Hashkel in life, that when you're involved in different aspects, you wear different clothes. The removal of the ashes, which is more of a more technical type of work, so you wore different clothes than the clothes that you wore to serve God. Continuing on in the text, "The fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it, it shall not be extinguished. And the Kohen shall kindle wood upon it every morning, he shall prepare the elevation offering upon it, and shall cause the fats of the peace offerings to go in smoke upon it. A permanent fire shall remain aflame on the altar, it shall not be extinguished." So looking at this text, even on a superficial level, we see, which is highlighted and underlined here, that there is a tremendous focus and emphasis on one idea, and it's listed three times, and clearly there is, halachically, that which we learn from that, and that's the concept of having a fire continually on the altar. The question I'd like to ask today is, on more of a philosophical level, what is this idea coming to teach us? We know that we don't have a temple today, but we also know, and we've spoken about this at length, that we as individuals become an altar, become a temple for God. So this law of having a fire continually on the altar must have some symbolism, some significance for our own lives. The question number one, what is that significance? What is that symbolism? The second part of the question is, in the context wherein we learn this law, of all the different korbanos, of all the different sacrifices, it's specifically with the korban ola, specifically with this burnt offering, which is offered completely to God, that we learn about having a permanent fire. Question number two, or the second part of question number one, is why do we learn this law, whatever significance it may have, specifically from the Korban Ola, specifically from this law. Third point, very famous, very beautiful idea of Rashi, that says that in the last verse, a permanent fire shall remain aflame on the altar. So the word permanent is extra. It's been telling us all the time that it's coming, that it's permanent. So says Rashi, a fire continually, it's a fire about which continually has been stated. It is the one with which they light the lamps of the menorah, about which it says to light a lamp continually. It too shall be set alight from the fire which is on the Mizbeach. Very fascinating Rashi. From where did they get the light to light the menorah in the temple every day? they got it from this fire that was kept lit on the Mizbeach. So instead of creating, you know, striking a match, whatever they did in those times to have a fire, they would take it from this lamp that was continually, this flame, on the Mizbeach. So the third question we need to try to examine is, what's the connection? It's not just a technical aspect. There's clearly a deeper connection between the fact that the menorah was lit from this fire on the Mizbeach. Our final question for the morning is another interesting law. Some of these seem a little bit difficult because we're not familiar with them, but the significance and symbolism is very, very powerful. And that is what the Shem Yishmuel notes, a very famous question. He says in Source 3 that this Sedra contains the theme of the previous one and examined details of various offerings which were brought in the Mishkan. It is intriguing to note that the Torah requires that the chatas, the sin offering, to be slaughtered in the same place in the courtyard of the Mishkan as the Ola, as the burnt offering. Pasuk says in our parsha, this is the law of the chatas, in the place where you slaughter the Ola, slaughter the chatas before God, it is most holy. So it's interesting that when we're told to slaughter the sin offering, it doesn't say slaughter in the northern side. It says slaughter it in the same place where the Ola was slaughtered. That's how it teaches us where to slaughter it. And we know, continuing, that the Ola itself was slaughtered to the north of the altar. We learned that from last week's parsha. Slaughter at the side of the altar to the north before God. And he said, this is fascinating. The Torah mandates that the Ola be slaughtered in the north, and then instructs us to do likewise with the Chatas, which asks two questions. Why does the main instruction appear with the Ola? And the second question is, why is it that the Chatas follows the Ola? There seems to be absolutely no connection between the Chatas and the Ola, but yet the Torah connects the two. That just like the Ola is sacrificed in the northern section, so the Chatas should also be sacrificed in the northern section. So the Ola seems to be primary, and the Chatas seems to be like dragged along with the Ola. So the question is, why is the Ola primary? Why is the Ola sacrificed in the northern section? And what is this concept of the Chatas being dragged along with the Ola? Before you start to think this is totally relevant to all of our lives, let's go start learning. We'll see the beauty in this and how relevant it is to where we are at. It's a very beautiful insight of the Sfas Emes on the Parsha, where he notes that Kiyesh Esh Meir V'yesh Esh Saref. There are two types of fires. There's a fire that is Meir, that gives light, and there's a fire that's Saref, a fire that burns. And though the Sfas Emes understands the latter fire in a negative sense, it's to burn away the negative desires, I would like to take a look at the two fires, looking at the Esh Saref in a positive sense. There's an Esh Meir, there's a light that's going to enlighten, and then there's going to be a light that burns, that I like to understand it as a light of passion. And these two lights, I like to suggest, are the two models of what each and every one of us need within our own lives, in our own altar that we each embody. So I'd like to speak about our two continual flames that are found within us and try to develop what they are all about. The first, the Esh Meir, is going to be the fire of knowledge, the fire of machshava, the fire of thought. And the Esh Saref, the second fire, is going to be the fire of passion, the fire of desire, hislavos, toward God. As the title of the Shir expresses, the fire of pensiveness and the fire of passion. Let's try to understand the first level first. I think to appreciate the first level, we need to understand why indeed was the Korban Ola brought. What was the reason? What did a person do that necessitated bringing a Korban Ola? So there are three things that one would bring a Korban Ola for. One of them, found in Source 5, is that the Ola sacrifice mitigates the transgressions of someone having entertained sinful thoughts. So a person had some sinful thoughts. He was going to do something he shouldn't be doing, and he realized that he was all consumed by these sinful thoughts, and therefore what he decided to do was to bring a Korban Ola, to bring a sacrifice that would be given completely over to God. So on this, the Yalkut Lekach Tov put in the Sivas Chaim asks a fascinating question. It says, if we would think about the case of an individual who had sinful thoughts, didn't do anything about them, just had sinful thoughts, And he's bringing a korbanola, a sacrifice that's burned completely to God. And then you have a second individual who committed a crime. Granted, he committed it by accident. But had he done this on purpose, he would have gone on a terrible crime like kares, like being cut off the people. Like he did a transgression on Shabbos but didn't realize that it was Shabbos or didn't realize that what he was doing was wrong. So such a person would bring a korban chatas, would bring a sin offering. So says the Nesivos Chaim the following. Says, let's take these two individuals. One person has terrible thoughts but didn't do anything about it. His sacrifice is burned completely to God. The second person actually did an action which was not a positive action. Okay, he didn't do it on purpose. Nonetheless, he thought about doing something. He did something. The reality was he did something not good. And yet, that person's korban, that person's sacrifice, only part of it is burned and part of it is eaten. We would say to ourselves logically that it should be what? It should be the exact opposite. We would say that that which is a person doing something wrong, so such a person's sacrifice should be completely burned to God. But if you only had bad thoughts, so then it's not so bad if you eat part of the sacrifice. So here comes the key, says the Nesivos Chaim. And it's intriguing because it's not the way we normally think. He says, we see from here that what is worse is thought rather than action. Why? He says, because when it comes to thought, where the bold print is in 6, ha-machshava chayevet liyoz kula kodesh, our thoughts have to be completely to God. As kishmit asikim b'sarchei aguf, even when we're involved in items having to do with our physical aspect, our thoughts connected with it have to be tahora, have to be pure. While, he says, in the world of action, what happens is reality sets in. So you're eating a meal. You're right. It should be for totally for God. But you know what? You're enjoying the chocolate ice cream. So you're enjoying it. So it's not having to do with God at the moment. Life is that when you're involved in physical pleasures, it's very easy to get caught up in the physical pleasures and not to think about God. So says in the Nesivos Chaim, a fascinating insight. He says, where do we hold a person more accountable? Where are we burning the entire sacrifice so that no person should gain any benefit from it? From a sacrifice that has to do with the thought aspect rather than the physical aspect. Because to a certain degree, the physical aspect perhaps may be out of our control. But thoughts are never out of a person's control. Thoughts have to be totally for God, have to be totally focused in a certain direction. This is brought down in Source 8. How does the Torah hold a Jew culpable for sinful thoughts? Aren't thoughts a person's private domain? Could it not be claimed furthermore that the ideas which flash through one's mind are beyond his active control? So says the Rambam, no, sinful thoughts only enter a heart which is devoid of Torah wisdom. If you're going to create a vacuum in your thoughts, if you're going to create empty space, so then that is going to welcome in all these sinful thoughts. We have the ability to set up the agenda of what we are thinking about. And he says quite clearly on the next page, this goes against all of what we'd call Western culture and philosophy. We live in a society which is so aptly described as that which is politically correct. We do that which looks good on the outside. What happens to the privacy of my own home? Well, that's a whole different story. It's the etiquette that counts. You know, it's the famous, it doesn't have to be a true story, it's a model of people who are sitting down together and they're talking, and there's one piece of cake in the center of the table. Will anyone eat that last piece of cake? What's the answer? No, of course no one's going to touch that cake. For a second, the lights go out. When the lights go back on, what do they find? They find one person's fork in the cake and 9 other forks in the guy's hand taking the cake. That's what life is all about. When the lights go out, so it's free game, that piece of cake to everybody. Judaism says no. Judaism says we have to have a yediyah shelefanav yisperach hakol galui v'yadua. In front of God, everything is known. It's almost a little bit scary. But we have to understand that that which goes on in the public world, as well as that which goes on in the private arena, as private as what goes on in my mind, is all galui v'yadua, is all open in front of God. And that has to be our understanding. That the Korban Ola is burned completely, saying to ourselves that you have to understand the severity of these sinful thoughts that's burned completely. No one can enjoy any part of the sacrifice because that we have a tremendous amount of control on. And in fact, it's a very interesting Hasidic understanding based on the Shlach Kadosh, according to Rav Moshe Cordovero in Source 11, that there's a great skula, there's a great thing to help a person have proper thoughts. And that's to say this verse in our selection today of Eish Tamid Tukad Ala Mizbeach Lo Tichbeh. Constantly have a fire on the altar, Lo Tichbeh, do not put it out. To explain success, Sofer, what does this mean? It means if you're constantly thinking that you need to have a fire constantly on the altar, which means it's a fire directed toward God, so then you have no room for bringing any other thoughts in. Your thought is only, how can I serve God? How can I focus a life connected to God? And that explains, on this level, why the fire was taken to light the menorah. Because we know the menorah is the symbol, and we spoke about it last year in Parshas Baalotcha, the symbol of learning, the symbol of Torah Shebaal Peh, the symbol of what Torah is all about. The fire being given to the Torah is a model for us of how do you keep that flame alit on the Mizbeach, connect it with the menorah, connect it with thoughts of Torah. Fill your mind, it doesn't only have to be learning, but fill your mind with proper thoughts, and therefore you will go on the straight path of an Eish Tukad al Mizbeach, of a fire constantly focused on how can I serve God better. Let's try to understand this idea a little bit deeper here. Try to understand the concept of the continual fire and why the thought process is connected with fire. So says Rav Wolpe in Ali Shur, on a selection called, a chapter called Machshava, he says in Source 13 that the concept of Malchus, the concept of Melech, of kingship, is the concept of Machshava. And that's why very often you have the concept of someone being Nimlach, someone being asked a question of what do you think on this, to ask advice. The concept of Malchus and the concept of Machshava are very much interconnected. Why? So he says, is that Melech hu baal machshava shebahu manhiga medinato. What is a king? A king is someone who uses wisdom in order to lead his nation. Likewise with a person as well. A person's machshava, a person's thought process, is what is the melech, is the control of who the person is. This is a famous insight of the Kuzari. Once again, Rabbi Karapkin's translation. He says, the saintly person is a leader. All of his senses and attributes, both spiritual and physical, submit themselves to his command. He thus leads them like a real-world leader. He muzzles his physical desires, prevents them from intensifying by feeding them their due and providing them enough to satisfy their needs. He feeds his senses their due by using them for productive purposes. He then continues by controlling his imagination, perception, discretion, and recollection, and finally his decision-making faculty, which utilizes all the aforementioned. All of these, in turn, act under his intellect, not under his lusts and desires. The machshava, the thought process of a person, has the ability to take the entire person and control every aspect of where the person is at. If a person says they're not able to control their thoughts, it's a person who's not in control of self. If you really understand that a person is a melech, we are the kings and queens of our bodies, of our minds, of our temptation, of everything that goes through our minds, we understand that we can control everything. But here's the punchline, my friends. It's not only that we can control everything, says Rav Wolpe with the asterisks in 13. This is the key. What a person thinks, that is really an expression of the essence of a person. You want to know who a person is? Walk into what they think about. Walk into their mindset. That is the best indication of where a person is at. And that's why it's the famous Gemara we've dealt with in the past. If someone says, behold, I betroth you on condition that I'm a righteous person, and right now he's a wicked person, the marriage is a valid marriage. Why? Because Shema Hirer Tshuva, perhaps he had bedato, perhaps he had thoughts of doing, of repenting. Those thoughts create a reality of who you are, and the marriage is a good marriage. And that's why when our rabbis say, is that hirurei aveira kashuma aveira, thoughts about doing sins is really worse than a sin, is because oftentimes we sin, but that's not really who we are. We got tempted by something, and that's why we're doing it. But that's not our essence. But when we sit and think about doing something wrong, that's really a statement of what's going on inside of our minds, what's going on inside of our heads. The machshava, really, the thought, really defines who a person is and what a person is. And that is why this imagery of the first imagery of the fire on the Mizbeach, which is a fire that's a constant fire in our service of God, it's the concept of an Esh Meir, a fire that can enlighten, and that is our mind. Our mind has the ability to enlighten us and understand that our mind is really the defining character of who we are. But this imagery of the fire continually being on the altar is really the perfect imagery of the mind. Because as we know, Rav Wolbe notes in Source 16, our mind never goes to sleep. Whether it's in the form of dreams or in the forms of thinking, our mind is constantly at work. That's the continual fire. We may be going to sleep, we think we're resting, but when we're sleeping, our mind is ablaze. How many of us have these wild dreams at night? I know personally for myself, I go to sleep thinking about a shiur, and in the morning, usually God is good to me, and the whole shiur is worked through. So I really didn't get that much rest. I was working the last 6 hours, perhaps not realizing I was working, but one's mind is always, we know this, we wake up with these ideas that suddenly come into our head. Our mind is always working. That's the fire on the altar that never sleeps. That's the fire of our mind that's constantly working, which is the definition of really who we are. Those Freudian slips are not such Freudian slips. They're the definition of the individual. And that's why, says Rav Wolbe, one of the most important things to learn to do in life in terms of one's avodas Hashem, service of God, is to get control of one's mind. To realize that you can and we do have the ability to train ourselves what to think about and how to think. Because as we know, we are so easily distracted. We think about something for a minute and then something, you know, annoys and we're thinking about that and then our mind moves to something else. And we say, well, I just can't help it. I'm just easily distracted. You're right. That's the nature of the mind. That's what you have to work on. And says Rav Wolbe, what he recommends is to take a quiet time in a quiet place. And listen to this. He says 3 minutes. And then he says 3 minutes is a long time. If you can master 1 minute, then you're lucky. Listen to this. And just think about one idea for 3 minutes and practice that for a month. It sounds so easy. 3 minutes to think about one idea? Sure, I'll set my kitchen timer. No big deal. You'll see how hard it is. But this is the training that we need in order to understand that if we begin to work on focusing of self, thinking about that we can control our mindset, we can control our thoughts, then what we're really saying is we are the melech, we are the king of who we are, and we're able to direct our service of God. Rav Wolbe adds one final point. He says, one should never treat one's thoughts like chativat etzim, like chopping down trees. Rather, ela linigun v'kinor, but rather like playing a musical instrument. And I think it's such a wonderful insight. And it's really the insight of what psychotherapy is all about. No one ever walks into a psychologist's office with a problem and they say, boom, we'll change your whole life right here now, 1 hour session, that's it. No. Psychotherapy can take years. Why? Because it's the playing of an instrument. The mind has to be changed slowly and carefully. It has to be worked on delicately and not with this tremendous force. Then we'll be able to master it, and then it will become ours. If we understand the centrality of one's mind, that the mind is really the essence of a person to a great degree, that which we think about really describes who we are as individuals. The Eish Tamid, the constant fire on the Mizbeach, is this representation that our fire has to be constantly for God. It has to be working on trying to direct our thoughts on how to become a better person, how to come closer to God, and not on sinful thoughts. And that's why in the section of the Ola, the section of sinful thoughts, that's when we have this command to have a fire constantly. Because if your focus is constantly on a positive sense and we can control it, and we know what we put into our mind, so then there will be no need for this Korban Ola, no need for this sacrifice. But we can take this a little bit deeper and explain with this as well, the connection between the Ola being sacrificed in the northern section and the connection of the Chatas, the sin offering, being sacrificed there as well. Let's take a look at the Shemi Shmuel, who says in Source 20, "To begin our investigation, let us consider an observation made by my Holy Father. The Ola was brought for incorrect thoughts without any follow-up action. My father noted that the word for north used in these verses is Safon. This word has the same root as Matzpun, meaning conscious or intellect. The Ola is slaughtered in the north because the north represents the intellect of man, the place where the sin requiring the Ola took place." He says, "This satisfies our requirement to know why the Ola is intrinsically associated with the northern area of the courtyard, but creates an additional difficulty. We have already noted that the Ola was brought only for the intellectual sins, those which involved no physical action at all, but remained as evil thoughts. On the other hand, the Chatas was brought for sins which were accidental. Had these sins been done deliberately, they would have incurred the divine punishment of Kares, of being cut off. This means that the Chatas was always brought for an action which had no intent behind it. The body was working without full control of the mind to produce an accidental act. As such, it is radically different from the Ola, where the Ola is 100% thought, the Chatas is zero thought. You did it by accident. You had no thought. So then why would the Chatas be brought in the same place as the Ola? One is for a thought without an act, the other for an act with no thought. Why then should they be so closely associated by the Torah that the Chatas takes its laws directly from those of the Ola?" Listen to what the Shemi Shmuel said. It's brilliant, my friends. This leads us to a discussion of the nature of accidental sin. Why does it happen at all? At a simple level, for example, a person forgets that it's Shabbos or that a particular action is prohibited, and during this period of forgetfulness breaks the law of Shabbos. Since his act was accidental, we treat him accordingly, making him bring a Korban Chatas. But why does this happen? We may suggest that when a person accidentally sins, there's more to it than mere chance. In reality, the person concerned has a strong desire to do a particular act, but refrains from actually doing it because he knows that the Torah prohibits it. He doesn't actually hate the idea of doing the act, but his consciousness of God's will prevails, holding him back from fulfilling his desires. This means that despite the fact that he's controlling himself, his desire for the act is creating a connection between the psyche and the deed. The consequence of this is that while he would never consciously do the sin, when his guard is down, that is when he isn't thinking, his reflex will do it, and that's the accidental sin. So now the connection between the Ola and the Chatas should be clear. Quite unexpectedly, both are offered for sins of the mind, for inappropriate sinful thoughts. In the case of the Ola, the thoughts remain thoughts. In the case of the Chatas, they resulted in accidental sin. As such, the atonement for them is very similar. And given they're both sins of the mind, they're both slaughtered in the north, which we know symbolizes the power of the intellect. It's very fascinating. We see the power of the mind. Where if the mind is not controlled, that which will occur is we will do things that we really desire to do. The mind has to be on for 24 hours. It's that fire that has to be a continual fire. We, for a moment, step away from that continual fire of thought, then accidental sins will occur. And it's really the same connection with the Ola, the primacy of our thought process, the primacy of being able to control that which we think. Bringing this level down to the world of the practical. So I think there are many practical applications to this. Thinking about how we can work on controlling our mindset more, for sure, is an important aspect. But perhaps that's a little bit too vague. I'd like to share perhaps one insight that's a little bit more specific that we can take home in our pockets today. It's from a new book that I just picked up on Friday and I fell in love with immediately. It's called Love at First Sight. The Shar Press is coming out with Rabbi Twersky and Rabbi Pliskin's book and like these self-help style small books. Pliskin called Kindness. I never got into Rabbi Pliskin and Happiness, maybe because I just think happiness is too elusive a state to reach. But kindness I could get into, so I picked it up. And I found it, I haven't gone through the whole thing, but that which I've gone through, I found to be absolutely charming, absolutely warm and wonderful, and a wonderful way to remind ourselves of the small ways of doing acts of kindnesses in this world. So are there any chidushim here? Probably not. But will it inspire a person? I think 100%. So in one of these short little essays, says Rabbi Pliskin the following, entitled First Thoughts. He says, what are your first thoughts when you meet another person? People of a strong tendency to be takers think, what can this person do for me? People with a strong tendency to be critical think, what can I find that is negative about this person? That's an interesting question to ask ourselves. When we meet people, what's the first thing that comes into our mind? Some people tend to think, do I like or respect this person? Others focus on, do I feel comfortable in the presence of this person? And yet others think, and this is the group I like the most, what does this person think of me? And that shows you a lot of where a person is at and how you respond to that question. So he offers the following suggestion, something to think about, I think very important. When you meet someone, let your first thought be, what can I do for this person? This way, you will view each encounter with a fellow human being as an opportunity to give and to help. He says it's relatively easy to develop the habit of asking this question. At first, you need to deliberately ask yourself this question over and over again. Asking it enough times will cause it to pop into your mind automatically. After a while, as soon as you meet someone, you will hear the question, what can I do for this person? And that's why he says, just concluding this idea, he says, as you repeat the question, what can I do for this person, think of specific people you know. Begin with people you like a lot. Then think of those towards whom you are neutral. And then finally think about those whom you experience difficulty when you deal with them. And try to work on this as being the mindset. I think it's what we're speaking about today. If we realize we can control the way we think, so then we can also control the situation when we encounter people, in terms of what is our first thought that comes to our mind when I meet people, well, that's going to decide the relationship that I'm going to have with that person. It's also going to decide what positive value can ensue from such a relationship. It shows you on a very, very tiny level, a minuscule level, how if we can just train our thoughts in one area, the encounter between two people, how it can change the world. You see the power of positive thinking. You see the power of being in control of one's thoughts to train oneself to think in a certain way. That's the fire continually on the Mizbeah, the fire of thought, the Eish Meir, the fire of light. That's the first level. The second level is to look at another sin that one brought a korban olah. And that is found in 27, quote in the English, in the Medrash says, he is pardoned for having neglected the fulfillment of a positive Torah command, a mitzvah taseh. For example, having neglected to put on tefillin. Let's say you had an opportunity to sit in the sukkah and you did. An opportunity to eat matzah and you did. An opportunity, not that you did something negative, right? You didn't eat chametz on Pesach, but you should have ate matzah on Pesach and you did. You had an opportunity to do a positive mitzvah and you didn't do the positive mitzvah. So what's this level about? So I think if we think about it, that's the fire of passion. What is the reason why a person would fail to do a positive commandment? They're not in love with God enough. If you were really in love with God, would you forget to eat matzah? Would you forget to put on tefillin? Would you forget to eat in the sukkah? Gevalt! It's like forgetting your spouse's wedding anniversary. I mean, there's certain things in life you don't forget in life. If you're in love with God, if you're passionate about something, that's the fire of passion. And this is what writings of Lubavitcher Rebbe in the book Torah Studies, edited by Rabbi Sachs of England, writes. He says, as been mentioned before in 28, every aspect of the physical sanctuary has its counterpart in the inward sanctuary within the soul of the Jew. His heart is the altar. The altar in which the continual fire was to be set was the outer one. And for the Jew, this means that the fire of his love for God must be outward, open, and revealed. It is not a private possession to be cherished subconsciously. It must show in the face he sets toward the world. And that's why we have a command that this fire went on continually. On Shabbos, they traveled in the desert. That fire never died down. That's our fire of passion in our relationship to God. And then he quotes a very interesting Hasidic idea, the Maggid, of Meseret that says at the end of 30, the Maggid of Meseret says that instead of reading the phrase, it shall not be put out, referring to the fire, we can read it will put out the knot. The fire of love extinguishes the negative. It takes the Jew past the threshold of commitment where he stands in hesitation and says no. The remark of the Maggid stresses the fact that to put out the no, the fire must be continual. It must be fed by constant attachment to Torah and to mitzvot. Once, or occasionally, or not long ago, are simply not enough. The fire dies down, coldness supersedes, and the no is given its dominion. And that explains, in 32, the commandment, we read Parsha Zachar yesterday, of remember what Amalek did to you by the way as you came out of Egypt. How he met you, Korcha, on the way. Amalek is a symbol of coldness in the religious life. Korcha, as well as meaning he met you, also means he made you cold. The Amalek within the Jew attempts to do the same. It's a voice which says no when the love of God grows faint and weary. It's a voice which does not fear God. And we are commanded every day to remember Amalek. That is, never to let coldness enter and take hold of the heart. And that means that the fire of love must never be allowed to die down. Since it happens to be this year that Parsha Tzav is read because of a leap year, we'll read Purim, the story of Megillah and Purim this year. So this concept fits in so beautifully to the Megillah itself. We know in 33 that Amalek's power in a spiritual sense lay in their ability to cool down any exuberance Israel may have led in their service of God. Rabbi Miller in Yom Tov Shirim continues by saying in his speech, Shachasveros, Haman describes the Jews with the phrase, Yeshno Amachad, there exists a certain nation. Our rabbis point out that Yeshno is composed of the same letters as Yashnu, meaning they slept. There's a certain nation that is sleeping. Haman was hinting to the king that Israel was in a state of sleeping spiritually. It would be therefore a propitious time to destroy them. Haman achieved his momentary terrifying hold of Israel simply because although they observed all the commandments, the Jews lacked exuberance in their actions. Their performance was merely mechanical, robot-like. That's the Yeshno, the Yashnu, the sleeping, the coldness, the fire is being extinguished on the altar. The service of God has to be a service of passion. That's why Rav Wolbe and Ale Shur, in another chapter called Secha Regesh Vit Pa'alut, says that that is our key. It can't remain our experience of God in the level of Machshava, the level of thought. No matter, as we saw today, how important thought is, and thought really defines who we are. When it comes to our relationship with God, we have to take it from the level of thought to allow it to permeate our panemius, who we are as people. And that's why he says, according to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the study of Musar, the study of ethical works, a study like this book itself, this book of kindness, has to sensitize the person to become a better person, has to really wake a person up that there's more than intellectual relationship with God. It has to create a feeling of awakening, a feeling of bekirbo, that it's within a person. It has to change a person, but completely. That's why he says, the last page, he says, the learning of Musar in particular has to arouse a hitpa'alut, arouse a desire within a person. And says the Alei Shur, we live in a society where people are afraid or embarrassed to show emotion. People don't like to cry in public. People don't show the way they really feel. We live in a very cold society to a certain degree. That's not what Judaism says at all. Feel life. If it's a time for crying, so cry. If it's a time for laughter, laugh. Be in touch with your feelings. Be awakened by that which is happening to you around you. And the learning has to be, and our relationship to God through learning has to be something that's going to be alive, something that's going to be passionate. And that's how Drash Moshe, or Moshe Feinstein, explains that connection so beautifully between the fire on the altar being the fire that lit the menorah. Says Rav Moshe in 37, he says, it teaches you that when you teach students, you have to teach them with a yislavus gadol, with a tremendous passion, with a tremendous amount of enthusiasm. But says Rav Moshe, and this is really pedagogue, right here in Rav Moshe, he says, this fire and enthusiasm has to be from the teacher side and from the student side as a preparation to learning, but not to be confused in learning itself. Because sometimes if you get so passionate and so carried away in learning, you're going to make mistakes. But you have to awaken within the students a fire and a desire for the passion, so then they'll be ready to learn and open to learn. And this, bringing it down into modern day terminology, is what we call in education the importance of motivation in learning. Where there's a great series of three books. If anyone is a teacher, then this is a must for every teacher. It's on math, but it has nothing to do with math. It's called Motivation Counts. Every minute counts, and every minute counts more, something like that, by David Johnson. And the thesis of his three books is that the first 5 minutes of class makes or breaks your entire class. He says, oy vey voy, if you're going to teach a class to begin off with roll, you've turned off the kids already. It has to be something that's going to grab the kids immediately, so therefore they're going to have a desire to come and learn. The fire of the Mizbeach has to be brought into the fire of the Torah. Just add on a personal story. I remember many a year ago, I was teaching the laws, the Chumash of the Avodah Space Hamikdash, on Yom Kippur, the service that happened in Yom Kippur. It's a very dry section, considerably, of what the Kohen did, what the priest did in his service on Yom Kippur. So I remember, everything is hashkach in this world, it's divine providence. I was teaching at the beginning of a school year, and that summer there was an educational magazine put out by Yeshiva University called 10 Dot. And it said in the 10 Dot, you know, coming up with the next issue, a biblical laboratory. I said to myself, wow, I can't wait for the next issue. A biblical laboratory, that sounds so exciting. And I began thinking to myself, how could you create a biblical laboratory? So since I was about to teach this Avodas Yom Kippur, so I had the students build, every group of students build a model of what the Mishkan looked like, and I told them to make cows and to make people and to make all the objects we need. And every time we read a pasuk, so then the girl who read the pasuk would actually demonstrate on her little model what the Kohen did. And we had a grand time. We were taking food dye for their blood and sprinkling the blood. I mean, it was an amazing time. It turned out, the end of the story, is the biblical laboratory was a language laboratory on Hebrew language. It had nothing to do with what I was thinking about. But be that as it may, the point of the story is the following. That particular group was an eighth grade group. It was in Moriah and Englewood, New York, which were particularly apathetic. You know, the walk is the walk and the talk is the talk. We've dealt with teenagers. We know what they're like. When I was teaching this section, I had my most apathetic kids, I mean with a capital A, would walk in and say to me, Mrs. Smiles, can I read today? And that's what we're talking about. If you give them that motivation, if you put in that effort that they're going to want to, I mean, you couldn't even believe yourself if these kids wanted to read a Pasuk Chumash. So the Chumash itself you do, Yeshiva Das. That's what it's all about. If we understand that this is what is so crucial and so key in our relationship to God, it's this hislavus, this passion, so now we can understand as well the entire story of Purim. Purim seems to be so out of character in the Jewish calendar. We get a little bit wild, a little bit drunk, a little bit happy. How do we understand this? So says Rabbi Miller in Yom Tov Shirim, he says, with all that has been clarified in 39, we may now grasp the positive effects of the excitement that forms an integral part of the Purim celebration. It is essential, however, that these feelings be translated into our spiritual lives. In this way, we'll be stimulating the rectification that was carried out by Mordechai so many years ago in Shusha. And once we are infected with the proper enthusiasm or fulfillment of the Torah, it will lead us to another acceptance of the Torah in our times. Why do we get so carried away on Purim? It's to counter the Yesh Noam Achad. It's to counter that Shena, it's to counter that sleep. In life, we're so much asleep, so we have to go to the opposite extreme to wake up, to party, to get excited about eating, to get excited about drinking, to get excited about doing mitzvot. Purim is an exciting day. We all love Purim. We all look forward to Purim. But to take that Islavos, says Rabbi Miller, and to then be able to translate it, it's not only on Purim. The Islavos, the passion on Purim, has to be translated into now a second Kabbalah Satorah. That's the fire on the Mizbeach, the fire of passion, to get emotionally involved in our Torah. And that's why Rabbi Sachs continues, based on Lubavitcher Rebbe in 40, he says the essential implication of this is that every Jew constitutes a sanctuary to God. And even if he learns Torah and fulfills the commandments, if the continual fire is missing, the divine presence will not dwell within him. For his service is without life, and a trace of that distant sin of the golden calf may remain, the no, which is the voice of coldness. The Jew must bring life, involvement, fire to the three aspects of his religious existence, Torah service, and the practice of charity. Learning should not be something done merely to discharge an obligation and kept to the minimum required. Words of Torah should never leave the mouth of a Jew, and they should be spoken with fire. There's a wonderful story that's quoted in the Gemara on a statement of Bruria, a very famous woman, very brilliant, learned woman, the wife of Rabbi Meir. Bruria once discovered a student who was learning in an undertone. Rebuking him, she said, "Is it not written, ordered in all things and sure? If it, the Torah, is ordered in your 248 limbs, it will be sure. Otherwise, it will not." In other words, Torah should penetrate every facet of his being until he can say, "All my bones shall say, Lord, who is like you?" And that's why it's such a powerful difference to walk into a library and to walk into a Beis Medrash. The rule in a library is what? Silence. No one can cough in a library, you know, with all these people staring you down. Walk into any Beis Medrash, any place of learning, what do you have? A symphony of noise. People are talking out loud. It's so different. That's the environment of Torah learning. You have to be involved in it. If you're just going to passively read, it's not becoming a part of you. If you're going to speak it out and dialogue and you argue it back and forth and you get really emotionally involved, that's how they describe two people learning. It's like blade by blade of sword, of fighting it out. That is the experience of learning. That's the experience of it becoming part of you and who you are. Likewise, continuing in 42, service means prayer. And that's what it says in Pirkei Avos: do not regard your prayer as a fixed mechanical task, but as an appeal for mercy and grace before the All-Present. And the practice of charity includes the fulfillment of all the commandments. Should not be performed merely out of its conscientiousness, but with an inner warmth that manifests itself outwardly in a desire to fill them with as much beauty as possible. Last point. How do we bring this to our lives? How do we reach this level of this hislavus, aside from clearly, again, the obvious, becoming more aware that we need to be filled with this passion? So says again Rav Wolbe in the Alei Shur, the key is sensitivity. If we are sensitive people, and as he describes it so beautifully, he says, if we are not sensitive, that's the concept of timtum halev, our hearts are closed up. That's the concept of tuma, impurity. Kedusha, holiness, is here, gasha beruchniyot, is we feel the sensitivity in life. One of the ways to become passionate people, have this fire on the altar, is to really be sensitive people to everything that happens around us, to be alert, to be awakened to that which happens. And if we have this sensitivity, says Rav Wolbe, we're going to be in touch with the feelings of people around us. We'll be in touch with their joy, with their sorrow, with their ability to be sensitive to their needs and to who they are. Sensitivity. If we walk through life completely impervious to that which is going on around us, so then we're not going to be open to a passion with God. When, for example, an ambulance or a fire truck passes us by on the street, do we stop and say a chapter of Psalms right there on the spot? That's sensitivity. That's saying there's somebody in pain, somebody in need at this moment. Am I going to offer a prayer on that person's behalf? This is what we mean if we walk through a life of that type of sensitivity, of that type of consciousness, that even a siren isn't going to pass us by without us responding in some way. That is opening the channels in our heart to have a relationship of God, that's a relationship of emotion, that's a relationship of passion. And that's why it's not by accident that the reason on this level, the chatas is offered in the place of the ola, says our rabbis, is because the chatas was done for somebody who actually did a sin. Well, the ola was brought for a number of various reasons. If the chatas was brought in a separate place in the temple courtyard, so everyone would see this individual bringing a chatas and say, "Ah, I wonder what sin he did." when it's brought in the same place as the Ola, a person can say, well, I don't know if he's bringing a Chatas or he's bringing an Ola. And that's the sensitivity we need, so nobody should question why that individual is bringing a Korban. It's not by accident that in the selection that's teaching us to have a fire continually on the Mizbeach, a fire of passion, is a section that's teaching us about the fire of sensitivity to another person. They're all interrelated. If we have that empathy, if we have that compassion, if we open ourselves up to Kedusha, Hargasha Ruchniyot, it's a real sensitivity to life. It's a sensitivity to people, sensitivity to that which happens around us. We awaken ourselves to the emotional aspects of life, so then we're able to apply that in our relationship with God and bring more emotion, bring more fervor into our lives. And therefore, in summary, we try to see today that laws that seem so distant from our lives are really talking very much about who we are as people. There are two constant fires that we need to have within our own altar. It's a fire of thought, where our thoughts go on 24 hours a day. We have to be the melech, we have to be the king of our thoughts. The thoughts define who we are as people. And therefore, for improper thoughts, we bring the korban olah. The thoughts, therefore, have to be filled with Torah-directed thoughts. From this fire lit the menorah, the symbol of Torah. And that's why the Ola and the Chatas were brought in the same place, because it shows us the centrality of thinking and what happens when you lose your grip on who you are. Practically speaking, think about it when you meet somebody. What are your first thoughts? Can we train ourselves to think about how can I help this person? The second level is the fire of passion. We didn't do a positive commandment. We lack that passion, enthusiasm, and our service of God. Take that fire and light the Torah. Light the menorah, the aspect of Torah. Take that fire and really be able to transmit it in our relationship with God. In everything that we do, the story of Purim, take the message and the spirit of Purim into our lives through the acceptance of the Torah. How do we accomplish this? Sensitivity. When those sirens are around us, when somebody is hurt, to stop, to take a moment out to help another person. If we open ourselves up to these emotional experiences, if we're sensitive to the fact that the Chatas and the Ola are put in the same place not to embarrass somebody, then we can open ourselves up emotionally to have an emotional relationship with God.